Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Thursday, January 24th, 2019. I am John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary Magazine, the 70-odd-year-old monthly of intellectual analysis, political probity, and cultural criticism from a conservative perspective. We invite you to join us at commentarymagazine.com, where we give you a few free reads and ask you to subscribe, $19.95 for a digital subscription and $29.95 for an all-access subscription, including our beautiful monthly magazine in your mailbox 11 times a year. Please go to iTunes or Google Play or wherever it is where you subscribe to this and leave a review, because I keep listening to other podcasts and everybody says that, so it must be very, very important for you to leave a review. But if you leave a review that's less than 5 stars, you're a terrible person and you should be ashamed of yourself, because you're listening, so you must like it. So how many stars do you actually want to give it if you keep listening? Let's face it. Opposite me, Associate Editor Norm Rothman, just days away from the publication date of his first book, Unjust, being released on Tuesday. Hi, Noah.
Hi.
Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
And in Washington, incoming senior writer, Christine Rosen. Hi, Christine.
Hi, John.
Okay, guys. So we're at like the 35th day of the government shutdown, and from all evidence, it appears that even the president now understands that what he has done to himself is a political act of personal jujitsu, the unforced error, the brain mistake, whatever you want to call it. I'm sorry if you're a Trump admirer, but the evidence is all in. He's down to 36 or 34 in approval rating in polls of adults. By a margin of 15 to 25 points, everybody blames him for the shutdown. People are liking Nancy Pelosi more than they seem to have liked any House figure in decades. And so this is not gone well for him. And the fact that he yesterday or last night, after this back and forth on whether or not he should be allowed to deliver the State of the Union during a shutdown in the House chamber, he has sensibly, I think, back down, even if we want to make a whole case that Nancy Pelosi is violating classic norms by rescinding the invitation, because whatever classic norms she's violating aren't hurting her and seem to be hurting him, and he needs to make some kind of a peace so he can get himself out of this shutdown cul-de-sac that he's got himself trapped on. Yesterday on Twitter, I said that Trump with the State Union was like Boone in Animal House in the grip of the cops, saying, yeah, now I'm really mad, only his girlfriend Katie wasn't showing up to say to the cops, officers, they're raiding the Food King so that they would drop him and he could be freed. Like, he just doesn't know how to get out of this now. And again, if you are a supporter of the wall and you think this is all unfair and it's only $5 billion, that's all well and good. He's made his case and he's lost his case, as far as I can tell. Christine, do you have any sense of how you're rummaging around in conservative Washington? what is the general feeling there?
I think that's correct, how you put it. I mean, I'll give you one anecdotal example of the mood in Washington, which is that the local National Public Radio affiliate station is regularly soliciting shutdown stories from people who've been affected by the shutdown. And there's a lot of complaining on local news media about, you know, restaurant owners saying they're not, you know, making as much money, and the federal workers and the federal contractors who aren't getting paid, and how they're, you know, now he has to detail cars to make ends meet. And so you are hearing these kind of these stories, and I'm not saying this to undermine them at all. I mean, these are legitimate concerns that people have to try to pay their bills when they're not getting a paycheck, and they're federal government workers. And then juxtaposed with that is the kind of national level hysteria that's setting in that we were all talking about a little bit before the show about, you know, is air safety, the FBI not being able to do its job. And I think that even among conservatives who are sympathetic to Trump's immigration policies, frustration is building as to whether this is really worth the political costs that it's likely to exact on him. I don't think it is.
Hey, Noah, so if we go back to 2011, the big government shutdown against Obama that led by conservatives who...
There were two.
But
that was the first one.
In August of 2011, the big one. So one of the things that happened and was going on in the world of sort of conservatism was this idea that, you know, we needed to fight and the government should be shut down. We need to fight. And then if you ask, well, what's the end game? What are you fighting for? What is it that you want, right? What's the goal? Because Obama's president, so you're not going to get what you want through legislation, whatever. It could never really be answered. And of course, the end game turned out to be the bizarre act of sequestration. The government shutdown ended with a 10% sequester that did enormous harm to our military readiness. Here's my point. So conservatives now, or pro-Trump conservatives, I think are also in the he can't back down here. He can't back down. What choice does he have but to back down?
Yeah, I mean, going back to 2011, like that was the sequestration was a product of the Simpson-Bowles Commission and Barack Obama's acknowledgement that he had suffered pretty resounding defeat at the poll in 2010, at the polls in 2010, and he had to make some sort of a gesture in deference to what the Republican rallying cry was, which was public spending. And so they crafted this position, which was designed to be so incredibly stupid that no one would ever allow it to go into effect. It was this, everyone's ox got gored. Defense spending was going to get hit. Mandatory cuts in non-discretionary spending for entitlement programs. It was going to be such a disaster that no one would allow it to happen. And it went into effect, and it remained in effect for the better part of a decade. Which was probably the metaphor for our decade of current political dysfunction. Everybody who inaugurates a shutdown loses the shutdown. It's almost always Republicans, but Democrats did it too. And last year, in January 2018, they shut the government down after they got some chip funding because they wanted DACA with it too. They didn't get DACA with it too. Everybody revolted and bucked, and the Democrats had to back down. Republicans are going to too. It happened in 2011. It happened in 2013. It happened in 2018. It's going to happen now. And it seems like we do have to relive this Groundhog Day approach to government shutdowns every single time, because the partisan, the chorus on the flanks of both partisan sides convinces itself that there is some Machiavellian strategy that they can use to message the thing and ultimately bring people around to their side and carve enough people off on the other side.
Can I just intervene before Abe talks? So I just thought of something as you're talking about 2011. Obama believed that if he proposed the 10% sequester, Republicans would never agree to it because Republicans were defenders of defense spending. But he didn't understand that the character of the Republican Party had shifted, particularly with the 63 new House members who had no skin in the game when it came to defense spending particularly, and they didn't care. They were there to cut spending or make the government stop or whatever like that. And so he proposed something he thought couldn't possibly go through as a kind of gambit to scare them to get them back to the table, and they weren't scared and it went through, right? So in this case, that is Obama misunderstanding the politics of the moment that followed the election. And Trump has misunderstood the politics of America following the midterm elections of 2018. He does not understand that the Democrats are in charge, that he doesn't have a unified House and Senate to protect him so that he can go off and say whatever he wants in whatever way he wants.
At least he made a gesture, though, or Barack Obama made a gesture to Republicans. This would be like... if Barack Obama lost the 63 seats in 2010 and then came out and said, now I'm going to make you all fund Obamacare even more.
Right. No,
I mean,
but
it's just insane.
Right. But he would say, I'm only asking for $5 billion, whatever. All I'm saying is that when I say Trump has misread the politics, I mean he believed that he just needed to go back to his successful playbook of 2016 by yelling about the wall, and somehow that would stabilize the political situation, and he simply misunderstood his own base. The whole reason that he's down in the 30s is that this is where his own people are starting to desert him.
Okay, and that picks up exactly. I'll pick up right from there. So, what I'm wondering is, we had been saying that Trump had this 42% support. That was like that was his rock. They were with him thick and thin, right? And now it's down to, as you say, about 34%, 33%.
Well, 34, 36. I mean, if you do an average of the three polls of yesterday, which including the one that was pretty favorable to him, which was Fox News, you're at about 38.4.
Okay. So it's dropped appreciably. My question is, has that rock started to crumble away from him because they don't like the stories that Christine was mentioning and they don't like the dysfunction and they're worried about the good working order of government, or they don't like the fact that he's not winning? And if and that difference would speak to what happens if he backs down. If he backs down and people go back to work and that was the thing that was upsetting everyone, well, then that's good for him. If he backs down, and then it's conclusive that he's not the man that they wanted him to be, then that's bad for him.
We don't know,
right.
Obviously, and it's probably a combination. You would think, right? I think the idea it's never good for a president that the public would think, including his own people, that he doesn't know what the hell he's doing, right? That was Bush at the end of 2005, right? He didn't know what he was doing with Katrina. He didn't know what he was doing with Iraq. He, you know, they had Republicans had invested a lot in him emotionally with the idea that he was a good man, who was a serious person, who was, you know, fighting for us and doing all this. And the incompetence was the thing that started, that really bit at Bush and started to crumble his support and crumbled it throughout the next 3 years that he was in office. Trump, I think more than most, cannot survive the idea among his own people that he doesn't know what he's doing. They need to believe that he's playing four-dimensional chess. Because if he's not, then they come to the position or the vantage point that those of us sitting on this podcast would tend to seem to share, which is that it's just all improvisation and he does whatever he does to get through the next 5 minutes, and some of that's good. And we'll talk in a minute about one of the things that seems to be really good about that. And a lot of it is indifferent, and then a lot of it is just bad, and that's not helpful to the deal-making, you know, very stable genius idea that he promulgated and that a lot of people seem to have accepted.
Well, people who need to believe something, as you put it, find a way to convince themselves of it. I don't anticipate that there will be any revelatory moment where they say, okay, I've been lying to myself this whole time. That's not how human beings.
Well, that's not how it happened with Bush either. Bush, by the way, the third thing that got to Bush at the same time was immigration reform, where he proposed a very significant immigration reform package, and the furthest right elements of the Republican Party then, which were relatively small in number, but nonetheless deserted him on it. I think I've told this story before, but I went in March of 2006, I published a book about the 2008 election called Can She Be Stopped, about Hillary Clinton. I start my press tour going on dozens of radio shows across the country, conservative radio shows, and I realized that I was dead and the book was dead and everything was dead because nobody wanted to talk about Hillary and have a good Hillary bashing session. These conservative radio talk show hosts wanted to talk about Bush betraying the country on with this, you know, liberal immigration reform to a man. Like there were, I'm talking about 20, 30 different shows started with Bush, didn't want to talk about Hillary. And then I thought, well, that's it for me. This is at least Noah doesn't have that coming up with the book launch of Unjust next Tuesday here. And you,
I've
need to
already
go to
pre-ordered
Amazon.
It. I've pre-ordered it. Everyone should pre-order it.
Pre-order Unjust on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. Remember, Barnes & Noble does have or go to your bookstore and pre-order
that
it.
Story
there.
Doesn't really take me down gentle. I mean, there's a lot of anxiety.
I know there's always anxiety releasing. There's always anxiety releasing a book. You do not have this specific problem. Conservative Talk Radio will be happy to talk about social justice warriors, particularly in the aftermath of the Covington Kentucky
It seemed like we
story.
Were very near to a massive confrontation between the House and the executive branch right on the day that the book would have dropped, which would have been cosmic.
You mean the State of the Union address?
Yes, which is very near to a confrontation, but the confrontation just didn't happen. It kind of fizzled. Everybody sort of caved simultaneously.
And you know why? Because Pelosi and Trump and McConnell all got on the phone together and they said, Noah Rothman has a book coming out on the day of the State of the Union. Let's all agree to postpone it so that it gets a good hearing on the day of its release.
As, we should say, does our friend Sohrab Ahmari, who is releasing his memoirs from Fire by Water, I believe it's called.
That's what it's called.
Its journey from Tehran to New York City, socialism to market capitalism.
To Catholicism.
And, yes, and Islam
Catholicism.
To Catholicism, to yes. atheism to
well
Catholicism.
Put. Well put. Well put. Wonderful book, as is Noah's book. Excerpt of Noah's book can be read on commentarymagazine.com right now, called The Attack on Luck, from our February issue. So if Trump is failing, does that mean that the Democrats are succeeding? Are we in a zero-sum atmosphere in which one goes up because the other goes down? Or is this a more complicated political reality than that?
Well, this is a zero-sum game. Not everything is, obviously. That's sort of a narrow paradigm, but this is a conflict between the president and congressional Democrats. Republicans are sort of on the sidelines, so if he loses, they win.
I don't know that they're winning at the moment. To be honest, I don't think anyone likes how either side has conducted themselves, but he being the president and having said, I will shoulder this burden regardless of how it turns out, he's going to get more blame.
Well, Democrats were crafting, last I heard, legislation that would have provided $5 billion plus in border security funding, well more than the $1.3 they were talking about before. It just, everything was going to be in the bill except a wall. Nothing for a physical barrier, no language for a physical barrier. Don't call it a wall. Whatever you do, don't talk about a wall. No wall. But everything else. And by the way, border hawks who are serious about this thing, who actually know what they're talking about, don't want the wall. They don't care about the wall. The wall is symbolic. What they want is border security technology,
if you,
E-Verify, visa protections, that sort of thing.
If you look at some of the polling, particularly the Fox poll released yesterday, there was an enormous majority supporting more border patrol agents and a significant minority supporting the wall.
Because everything the Democrats talked about ahead of that the dueling speech session, where they said, this is all the stuff we prefer, is really expensive, way more expensive than what the president was asking for.
It's just a wall. All he wants is a wall.
It's
got this quality. It's like, all he could say is like, can't I just have the wall? What is it? It's a wall.
But that's,
you know what?
A failure.
I'll lose and you can knock it down. What do I care? Just give me a wall for 5 minutes.
But it's a failure of messaging on Trump's part. And I'm kind of surprised that he has a way out of this where he could still save face in a way that I think Abe's earlier point is crucial. If, in fact, they want him to still be able to talk tough on immigration, there's a way to do that and get the money to do border security, to change this from being about the wall to being about border security. And the fact that he isn't making that pivot is just, I think, bad judgment. Maybe it's ego, who knows what it is. It's a mistake.
But in other words, you're saying that he could still come across as hawkish on border security by giving up the wall?
Well, he wouldn't. He just has to reframe it, right? It's a marketing thing. It's no longer about the wall. It's about being tough on immigration. It's about border security, which is supposed to be what the wall is about. I mean, I feel like the wall has become his white whale. You know, he just can't.
Right.
He's just blinded to the political reality around it. And as Noah said, I mean, there are opportunities here for him to still satisfy his hardcore anti-immigration
Absolutely.
Base.
He could just say that he could frame it as he has pushed the Democrats into acknowledging that we need a much tougher border strategy and we need border patrol agents to stop these horrible monsters, you know, coming in and, you know, raping our children and leaving prayer rugs in, you know, in the middle of the Rio Grande Valley, you know, because they're going to commit terrorist acts in El Paso.
Trump doesn't have policy preferences. He doesn't know
no, except
what he
for
wants
the wall.
For policy. But no, that's not even a real policy preference. There was a thing in the New York Times, which I think confirms all of our suspicions, that it was a device that allowed him to talk about what was his wedge issue that rocketed him to 30% in the polls of Republican voters, and that was all he needed to win the nomination, which was being a border hawk. It was a device that he could say, we need to talk about border security, and then he would throw out a bunch of platitudes about how tough he was going to be on border security. He doesn't have policy preferences beyond the wall. If he did, he would talk about all these other border security measures that actually work.
But here's your mistake, okay? If you say... we're going to win the space race, or, you know, we're not going to allow a missile gap or something like that. The measurement of how you win or fail or succeed at that is kind of complicated and takes a long time and all of that. If you're going to say we're going to build a wall and Mexico is going to pay for it, you've said something unbelievably specific, because either the wall is built or it's not built, and either Mexico pays for it or it doesn't. And he has to walk it back, because in 2020... Democrats are going to say, you know what you did? You promised one thing. You said we were going to build a wall. You had the 2 years you had a Republican Congress. You didn't build the wall. We don't like the wall, but you have to look your own people in the face and explain why it was that the one promise that you made, incontrovertible, you were too incompetent to make happen. So if he doesn't switch the message, as Christine says, he is handing his opponents a gigantic mallet to bash him over the head with through 2020, which isn't like, I don't even want the wall, but you could have had the wall. You had the House. You had the Senate. Where's your wall? This is how you're tell them now what you're going to do from 2021 to 2025. Should they believe you then? It's like a gimme. It's the easiest message of all. You don't even have to talk about what you want. That's the good part. That's why he needs to say, I tricked the Democrat. I got him. I only really wanted tougher border security. They're so crazy about the wall. They wouldn't let me out of the wall, but we got 5 billion more Border Patrol agents.
So we're left to conclude that he's just not that savvy. He's not good at this.
That's what I think you need to take away from the fact that he decided to spend the month of January shutting the government down to get a border wall and seeing his polls go down by 15%.
So it's almost like Republicans have tethered themselves to a political neophyte who will destroy their majorities in Congress.
Well, destroyed only one majority in Congress.
Yeah, give it time.
I know. Anyway, let me just remind people about our friends at the Tikva Fund. Because for over a decade, they've been gathering students in summer programs taught by some of the best teachers of the Jewish and Western traditions. And now Tikva is bringing their master teachers right to your computer screen with their growing library of online courses, many of them conducted by some of the writers that you love most at Commentary, like our longtime contributor since 1969, Ruth Weiss, teaching Daniel Deronda, George Eliot's great novel of Jewish nationalism, and Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik, our Jewish commentary columnist, teaching about Jewish ideas in the American founders. You can also explore the inspiring Zionist leadership of Theodor Herzl and the brilliant religious mind of Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik if you're interested in Jewish ideas and the Western tradition, if you're an American patriot who cares deeply about the state of Israel, if you love to learn, if you're the kind of person who enjoys this podcast, these online courses are for you. And I will say that I've not only spent many hours listening to Sully sermonize and speak and deliver homilies at the Shabbat table, and he is one of the most compelling speakers on earth. I have actually listened to most of Ruth Weiss's Daniel Deronda lectures. This is a very important, difficult, complicated, flawed book. She is absolutely brilliant about it. Everything about that course will inspire you not only to read Daniel Deronda if you hadn't, but to look at it in 10,000 different new ways if you have, and to have your understanding of what Zionism means to those who, before Herzl, and this is a Zionist novel before Herzl, it's a remarkable achievement. So once you enroll in a Tikva course, you catch it at your own pace, on your own schedule, as many times as you like. Your enrollment will never expire. And for a limited time only one more week, that's like four or five more days, Tikva is offering Commentary podcast listeners the chance to enroll in as many courses as you like at a discounted price. Go to courses.tikvafund.org/commentary. I'm going to spell that for you. courses.tikvahfund.org/commentary. Use the coupon code commentary when you check out, and you'll get 25% any off any and all of TIKVAH's courses. Courses.tikvahfund.org/commentary. Use code commentary and you can buy all of TIKVAH's online courses for 25% off. Okay, so as all this is going on, meanwhile, out of nowhere, seemingly, and with a remarkable amount of preparation, totally foreign to the Trump administration's foreign policy so far, we have the spectacle of the United States withdrawing its support, or not withdrawing its support for
diplomatic relations,
right? But announcing that it no longer recognizes the government, the sitting tyrannical government of Venezuela under Nicolas Maduro, as the legitimate government of the country of Venezuela, and that we now recognize opposition leader. Okay, here we go. I'm going to give it a shot. Guaido, Juan Guaido, 35 years old, the head of the National Assembly. We now recognize him as the legitimate interim leader of Nicaragua. See where my head goes. Venezuela, pending new elections, having classically the two elections that preceded this one, after Maduro's party and Chavez's, Hugo Chavez, the late Hugo Chavez, Maduro's predecessor, lost an election. They simply lost the National Assembly. They simply reconstituted a different National Assembly and announced that that National Assembly was the National Assembly and that it counted. So, Noah, where does this stand, and why should we find ourselves impressed by what has happened with U.S. foreign policy over the last week?
Yeah, so good on the Trump administration. First of all, this is morally correct policy as well as good geopolitics. It isolates this regime. And based on the cascade of Western Hemisphere governments that came out in favor of this move and joined us in recognizing this this alternative government, these competing governments, suggests that there was a lot of groundwork that was done ahead of this, and that's a display of competence, and it's pretty savvy. You've pretty much isolated Venezuela with its, you know, the small cast of rogue actors around the world and who support this kind of thing, Bolivia, Nicaragua, Russia, China, and a variety of other, you know, mal actors in the universe, and good for them. You know, we've created some moiety between Cuba, obviously, between what is a responsible actor on the world stage and what is not. And that is, you know, sort of an interesting development, considering that this president has campaigned and governed in a way as sort of this arch realist, where we really couldn't have an ideological foreign policy where the agenda, the democracy agenda, was the freedom agenda, rather, was sort of tying us up in ways that were counterproductive to the advancement of American interests abroad. And this is a demonstration that you can't really get away from that. Now, I'm a little nervous about where this is going to go. As far as I understand it, the notion here that the military, which is all that matters, is going to back down and suddenly endorse the National Assembly seems to me like it's unfounded. The Maduro regime has been purging dissenting elements from the military for years now. It's been very effective at that. Military, even small-level commanders in the military, are forced to buy into the regime's crimes, either committing violence against civilians or narco-trafficking or any number of offenses that are designed to communicate that those commanders shouldn't be allowed to feel like they can outlive this regime. They're all in the same dock. And so now we're in a waiting game, and so
okay,
there's a lot of tension.
I submit, I don't know, but I submit that neither Trump nor the 11 nations that decided to recognize this new interim government, and to even all of whom believed that the election last year of Maduro was illegitimate, nonetheless, we haven't really seen anything like this happen before. And it strikes me that they must know, I don't know, but they must have better assurances than the idea that it's a wish fulfillment that the military was not going to intervene to save Maduro, given how immaculately they arrange this multi-nation withdrawal of recognition and new recognition for the other, for this new reality, that they know more than we know they know about what is going to happen in the streets. Everything you say is true, but that things may have changed to such a degree, or they may have gotten assurances to such a degree, that it must have seemed lower cost than we realize. This seems like a very risky move, and maybe it's not so risky. First of all, I don't think Trump would have signed on to it if it were as risky as you are making it out to be, precisely because it betrays his non-interventionist tendencies. In other words, if there's like a 2% chance that it's going to blow up, then maybe he'd say, sure, let's go with it. But if there's a 30% or 40% chance that it's going to blow up into mass violence that we're going to get blamed for, I feel like he'd say, nah, this is not for me. I mean, it's terrible. We hate Maduro. It's all awful. But, you know, this is not something the United States
needs to participate
in. I don't
understand why we would get blamed for mass violence.
Because we would have endorsed a dangerously reckless. It's already happening among non-interventionists in the United States who are saying we are endorsing regime change, we're being reckless, what we do is going to lead to, you know, immense amounts of blood in the streets, and so blood will be on our hands because we changed the status quo.
And didn't Mike Pence say that we support Venezuelan citizens who stand up against Maduro and for the opposition now?
Yeah, I mean, look, we are supporting.
That's insane. This has been happening since 2014. There's been blood in the streets.
No, but we
for 5 years.
It's not insane. We are saying that we support regime. We are explicitly saying that we no longer believe that the regime that nominally holds power is legitimate, and that the claim of the opposition is legitimate, and no longer will we treat the presidency of this, and so therefore this presidency should end.
Yeah, but Maduro those who announced, would say that we are responsible for the inauguration of violence ignore the fact that violence has been ongoing for 5 years. They shouldn't
I don't
be taken seriously.
Yes, you're right. That doesn't matter. Go ahead.
But Maduro himself is framing it that way, right? He's saying, you know, he just spoke on Wednesday. He said, the Times quoted him as saying, we're not returning to the 20th century of gringo interventions and coup d'etat. I mean, he's actually very, very much framing this as the kind of 20th century style intervention, you know, that there is a history of happening. So I think Noah's correct about the facts, but in terms of the messaging and how that's going to play out
and
both politically here.
You're right. And sensitivity towards that, pushing that button, is why Obama was so hands-off with this crisis over the course of 5 or 6 years. They allowed this violence to subside.
Obama felt burned because he semi-supported a coup in Honduras that failed in 2009.
He met with Chavez at the Organization for American States before that.
I know, but I would say we, the United States, effectively supported the failed coup in Honduras in 2009. And Obama got talked into that and felt like he had been screwed. He'd been screwed by his own people to believe that that was a good idea. Now, I do want to point out, while you say that everybody is terrible, it's awful, that our favorite new superstar congresswoman, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, has retweeted the tweet of her fellow freshman Democratic congressman, Ro Khanna, saying, with respect, the U.S. should not anoint the leader of the opposition in Venezuela during an internal polarized conflict. So it is
I'm shocked that socialists would unite behind socialists. Yes.
I mean, I will say this, which is socialists, Maduro and Chavez, the fact that socialists think well of Chavez and Maduro when they are systematically revealing that the unworkability and the inherent totalitarianism of socialism is a pretty startling fact. Like, they should be the first people to say this is a bastardization of socialism and they must go because they are blackening a great system's name. You know, what do they have to be? They're Sean Penn,
right?
And Michael Moore. They want to support Maduro. Maduro is a monster.
Starving. The people are starving.
It's a rich country, and they're starving.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, some people have been writing that. You know, some people on the left have been writing that. But Ocasio-Cortez and others are not. There's like some division here, and also it puts them squarely on the side of Vladimir Putin, and Donald Trump against him.
They'll never be made to defend that position.
They won't, but it is an interesting thing. Abe, you said earlier, make your point about this.
If Trump didn't go ahead with this, and I'm still baffled as to why he did. I'm very glad.
Me too.
I'm very glad too. About it. But if he didn't do it, surely they would all be saying, probably including Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, that he wouldn't intervene in Venezuela because he was scared to get crosswise of Vladimir Putin.
Right, or he was acting on Putin's orders not to. Right. So here's an interesting wrinkle of this whole thing. What we don't know is the extent to which this policy, as it has been laid out, the one person that we know has been working on this nonstop for more than 2 years is Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida. He has been talking about figuring out a way to achieve regime change in Venezuela since 2016. His office has been the epicenter of all meetings, negotiations, private dealings, all of that on the question of how to do something about the ongoing nightmare in Venezuela, the human rights nightmare, the economic nightmare, the destabilization nightmare for the rest of South and Central America. And it is likely that he has played a leading role in structuring this deal or leading to this that was taken up possibly by Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State, and the State Department, which, as we know, is not exactly staffed to effect lots of policy at that level. And so if this is true, and if Rubio has played a central role here, and if this works out that Maduro was driven into exile, Rubio will have revealed himself, not the, supposed empty suit who isn't a leader, blah, 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 that was said, that Chris Christie took him down for being in the debate in New Hampshire. He will have proved himself maybe the single most consequential senator of the last decade, if not longer, in affecting a major policy and helping the country to see it through. To sort of an interesting.
He's also. It's been interesting to compare his presence. He didn't comment yesterday. He was on lots of stuff was said. He posted a lot of things to his Twitter account. But meanwhile, his fellow senator Rick Scott was calling Maduro a terrorist. I mean, a lot more powerful rhetoric coming from Scott than from Rubio. But Rubio, I think you're absolutely right that he's actually, this has been a multi-year thing that he's been working on. And I think so far he's calling for, diplomacy once there's, free elections and I don't know, it's impressive.
Yeah. I mean, again, it appears to be a very high risk strategy that must not be as high risk as it looks, because I just don't think
that's not guaranteed at all.
I didn't say it was guaranteed. I'm putting this in the conditional.
I'm going to go back a ways. So I just recently watched a clip of Zbigniew Brzezinski with William F. Buckley talking about non-events, the courses they did not take with regard to the coup in Iran and the revolution in Iran. And those who were advocating for intervention on behalf of the Shah were up against sort of public opinion, especially in public opinion in places that mattered to the Carter administration and the State Department, over the idea that Khomeini was sort of a new Gandhi, that he was a reformer, and that the kind of violence that they were prepared to inaugurate would have been wildly disproportionate to the scale of the threat at the time. And then later on, found out that they executed a bunch of mass executions, that 20,000 people were stoned to death, that they attacked the embassy and what have you. And the rest is history. The non-events that policymakers wrestle with require somebody with a fair bit of foresight. I don't necessarily think that this administration has that kind of foresight, certainly not in the White House, maybe in the State Department, but certainly not in the White House. I don't think they weigh non-events like that. So, yeah, they probably just didn't think especially far-sighted about the prospect of a military confrontation. Exiles are probably coming home, and there's a lot of people who have been training, former members of the military, for this kind of event. And they're probably on their way back. I wouldn't.
You mean they're on their way back to fight against the military or with the military?
With the National Assembly.
So they're fighting for freedom and not for the
freedom as they define it. Yeah, the prospect of a civil war can't be ruled out.
It can't be ruled out in the future either. In other words, if there is a resolution of this that goes the way we think it, or goes the way we hope it would go, in which Maduro goes into exile and the interim government is recognized and their election schedule and all of that, that does not, of course, end the possibility that there will be a civil war down the road that the Maduro forces will encourage. Having said that, it is very, and I know people say this, but it's very hard to look at the pictures of Caracas and the other cities in Venezuela yesterday and the day before, and the number, the sheer magnitude of the size of the demonstrations, which seem to dwarf even the Maidan, the Kiev Maidan revolution. That was the last time we saw this kind of mass outpouring. I mean, it looked like every person in Venezuela was in the streets.
And there were only a couple of hundred casualties in the Maidan.
Right, and I mean, you know, the question is, does Maduro have the possibility of doing a Tiananmen Square massacre or not?
He has.
It hasn't happened yet.
Vastly more people have been killed in the uprisings in 2014 and 2016 than in the Maidan.
That's right. I know. And so we don't know what's going to happen now, but it's very hard to look at this. Say, you know, there is a person who has declared himself the legitimate interim. He doesn't even say he should be president. He is saying that he represents, in the terms of the Venezuelan Constitution, Guaido wrote a very good op-ed, or someone wrote it for him, in the Washington Post that laid out the ways in which what he is doing follows specifically three different conventions in the Venezuelan Constitution that Maduro has violated and that he is fulfilling. And so he is making a very Burkean case for why Maduro should be thrown out. He is not making a revolutionary case saying, I'm bringing new peace to the country. He is saying,
no, and he's saying
an election was stolen.
And I will hold elections as the temporary president.
Right. Yeah. And that what is going on here is fulfilling the mandate of the Constitution that Maduro himself illegally violated. That seems to me, this is a popular uprisings or what, it's not exactly a popular uprising, it's not exactly an uprising as we understand it then. It is a legal claim that is being recognized by multiple countries across the globe.
Invoking an article in the Constitution.
Articles in the Constitution.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
I have to say, I have a very hard time believing that the administration didn't think through the possible grave ramifications of military confrontation, because if this goes as we hope it goes, we'll all be thrilled. It will not be a huge story here. If it goes sideways, it will be enormous.
By the way, Trump last year said, maybe we'll have to use force in Venezuela. Right. I mean, this is not as though Trump, the president himself, I remember when he said it was like, what are you kidding me? We're pulling out of Iraq. Pulling out of the fight against ISIS, and then we're going to go to war in Venezuela? Give me a break.
Well,
but he did say it.
But doesn't that, I mean, suggest to you that perhaps the president hasn't thought out all the consequences of deploying a police force to a massive nation which is rich with oil and narcotics and weapons, and they have no idea what they're doing?
Okay, well, first off, I would say that I think this is Abe's point, that given the given his predilections toward non-interventionism, you have to assume that he did give it thought, because he is not going with going with his own flow. He is acting against what you would think would be his impulses.
And not only will it be a huge story because those who hate Trump will keep it alive, but that the 36% will drop significantly lower, because this will have been a total betrayal of what they thought of him in terms of foreign policy.
If this is what they thought of him in terms of foreign policy, this is one of those things where the test of this is very complicated. We've never had a real world test of whether or not, you know, the people that we think of as being sort of hawkish Republicans suddenly went dovish and isolationist because Trump came along to represent them, or if they're just going along with him and are perfectly happy to see Americans shooting up places.
Right.
No, if it is framed, which as it should be, as a Syria in our hemisphere, as a refugee crisis with which we would have to contain, then yeah, I think you could make a pretty compelling case. And the Republican Party isn't against deployments. They really haven't been a non-interventionist party. There's non-interventionist elements to which Donald Trump plays, you know, pretty well politically, but he's not governed that way.
Right. He really hasn't. So that's why,
this Syria pullout situation, which is sort of on again, off again, is demonstrative of the fact that the Republican Party doesn't have a non-interventionist infrastructure. There's no intellectual infrastructure there. There's not a lot of people who subscribe to that point of view in the Republican Party. It's just what the president's little, you know, bugbear is today.
Right. But, you know, it's funny because if you look back 30 years ago this year, was our the U.S. action in Panama. And the U.S. action in Panama followed Noriega, the dictator of Panama, refusing to accept the results of a legitimate election, and then a failed coup. They were then working, the U.S. forces were working to figure out a way to get Noriega out of Panama. They couldn't do it. And then there was a failed coup, which was put down quite brutally. And then the U.S. said, there's no way we're ever going to get him out of there because he's clearly not going to. And so we then took the action that we took. This is working in a completely different fashion. I mean, the way it's working here is that we are essentially following along a legitimate effort to, a legitimate effort being taken in Venezuela to unseat an illegitimate government through a legitimate constitutional means, and we are merely endorsing it. That's all we're doing is saying we accept the contention that Guaido's argument is sound, that he should be the interim leader of Venezuela, and we are therefore no longer recognizing the government.
Which is perhaps why the White House could reject the notion that they own any of the consequences.
I know. Well, we'll see. But as we know, the White House, where I will agree with you, is the White House has a history of believing that nothing is going to blow up in their face that does, like the Jared Kushner saying, don't worry, you can fire Comey. Democrats hate Comey. It's not going to have any consequences for you. But that said, I was racking my brain, and I sent a couple of emails to people who know a lot better than I, and I can't remember anything like this really ever happening before. I mean, maybe this method of regime change is new in some fashion, but it's very hard to remember anything that followed this pattern, you know, illegitimate election, constitutional claim, and then we just endorse. I mean, there are cases in which we have not accepted the legitimacy of a government. We didn't accept the legitimacy of the Soviet domination of the Baltics for 45 years either, and did not believe that we believed that those were independent nations, and we even recognized their sort of symbolic governments out of power. This is new, I think.
The 1991 coup comes to mind.
Which, in Moscow?
Yeah.
Well, did we recognize? I mean, did we?
I don't remember.
The coup was against Yeltsin, right, and it failed.
Yeah.
So this is not like we endorsed the coup against. Yeah, I mean, this is not. That was an easy one. Like that was the last gasp of the old regime.
Yeah, but it was also after Yeltsin was elected the head of the Russian government.
Yeah, but I'm saying that was a coup against someone we viewed as a legitimate government, and we didn't accept the coup. So anyway, it's nice to have a conversation about foreign policy for 5 seconds that is about something new.
And that's not about a looming catastrophe.
Right. Can I ask
Slow down.
Can I ask one question? Let me ask one question and sort of throw around. So for years, people on the right have been saying, I hate the State of the Union. It's terrible. We shouldn't have it. Shouldn't have it. It's monarchist. We have coming into the chamber and being treated like he's elevated. It's terrible and it's boring and we shouldn't have it. And now, you know, Pelosi suspended it or canceled it, whatever, pending the shutdown. I assume there'll be one once the shutdown is over because Trump is not obliged to issue it. It's from time to time. It says in the Constitution you have to deliver, you know, you have to deliver a message on the State of the Union. I think, even though it's true that the speech is mostly unmemorable and all of that, this is a pre-Trump, one of the things that made it possible for there to be Trump, which is this whole notion that, the State of the Union's boring, let's cancel it. So what, one night out of the year, there can't be an hour, that the television can't like be canceled for an hour so everyone should either watch the speech or watch Netflix? I mean, is it such skin off everybody's nose that the president gets an hour to stand in front of the Congress and give a speech that doesn't really have that many consequences? Did it really get to the point at which, you know, this is where we get to even this? What was so terrible about it?
Well, I think what annoys a lot of people about it, I mean, at least it annoys me, and I think this is likely a more recent phenomenon than in prior to this in our history, but it's now just it often sounds like a campaign speech, right? I mean, you have the kind of token people sitting with the first lady who wave when they're called upon to, you know, exemplify some point that the president's making. And this is not a partisan point. This is just presidents now use this as a kind of opportunity to try out their reelection stump speech or to boast a little. And honestly, I think I don't think it's that people don't want to give the president that platform. It's just that it's become so much empty rhetoric or posturing that nobody takes it seriously.
I also think, I mean, it annoys me as well, but not a tremendous amount. But the theater of it has started to sort of leave me cold. You watch it and you sort of get this, all right, get over yourselves kind of feeling.
I think it's despicable. It mimics the Queen's speech. It was not part of American tradition for hundreds of years until President Wilson brought it back, who is this side of a fascist. And frankly, anything that he has brought back into the American political culture should be soundly rejected. It's only just a matter of Republican hygiene.
Tell us how you really feel, Noah. But Trump must. I think John is right, though, that it must be something that Trump would enjoy doing, though, right? I mean, this is you know, he gets to perform the presidency, which is what he loves to do.
No venue would be even remotely close to the deference that is displayed by the entire federal government to him on that platform, and even in the Senate, the physical platform doesn't exist in that chamber for him to enjoy the kind of awe and respect that you get during the State of the Union address. So yeah, I mean, anybody who's doing stagecraft couldn't find another place for him to do something like this.
All right, so you guys don't like the State of the Union. I'm just saying, like, you know, better that than the crap that Trump promulgated from the Oval Office in that border shutdown speech. I mean, I'm just saying, like,
why would you want to do that twice?
No, here's what I'm trying to tell you. Like, you get rid of, first of all, the State Union's been delivered the same way for 105 years. That is starry decide. That is a tradition. You may claim that it's a new tradition, but a century is a long tradition. And secondly, like, why? You know, you do away with these moments at your peril. You think you can just, you know, sort of like crap on them, and then who cares? And then you have no formal institutional moments at which the leaders of the country sit together in a chamber for an hour, which may be more meaningful than we realize. That the House and the Senate and the Supreme Court are all sitting there together listening to the president speak while the president of the Senate and the speaker of the House are sitting
behind. The president can convene a joint session of the Congress almost at his discretion, not entirely, but almost. And the president has done so on repeated occasions, often for political events, in order to propose this policy or the other based on whatever national emergency that he seems to think is necessary to address it. And it becomes a de facto State of the Union.
Okay.
So you can do that whenever they want. You can do it 2 times a year if you wanted to. You can do it every month. But it's not great from the perspective of somebody who I believe, and this is just a philosophical thing, one of the best parts of American political culture is that we don't penalize or stigmatize the dropping out of the political process. That you have the freedom not to participate, not to partake, not to
be part of the civic compact,
with some exceptions, you know, some real basic elements.
But you can watch the Big Bang Theory on TBS during the State of the Union. And I mean, I'm just saying, it's not as though you are compelled to watch the State of the Union. You can do all kinds of other things during the State of the Union. This isn't like, you know, when you go to Oral Roberts University and you are mandatorily required to go hear, you know, Ann Coulter speak, which apparently is one of the things that happens at Oral Roberts University. Anyway, with that rather stupid way to conclude, we'll conclude. So... my father actually told me that. My father went to Oral Roberts University and he came back and he said there were like 10,000 people there. And I asked, it was so amazing. And I asked why. They said because attendance was mandatory. Anyway, which is, you know, it's true because I went to speak at Connecticut College and there were 14 people there. So I would have appreciated a mandatory assembly rule. Anyway. So for Christine Rosen A. Greenwald and Noah Rothman, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.